The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. If you're enjoying the show, head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make The Sewers of Paris possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello, I'm Matt Baum, and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast search for the entertainment that changed the lives of queer people. My guest this week is author Benji Carr, whose novel Impacted comes out next week and is the product of a lifelong obsession with soap operas. That's not entirely surprising, as Benji's own life was often more dramatic than he knew how to handle. It was shows like Melrose Place, Knott's Landing, and Desperate Housewives that helped him make sense of the chaos in his own life, and eventually deal with it more productively than the fictional characters he'd grown up watching. And just a quick heads up, this week's episode contains mention of childhood sexual abuse. Here's my interview with Benji. Well, this week I'm speaking with Benji Carr, former journalist and now author of Impacted. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. Hello. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to talk to you about the entertainment. What is the entertainment that changed your life?
Knott's Landing.
Wow. Okay, great. We have never discussed Knott's Landing on the show in 300-something episodes. So tell me about what that show is and why it's important to you.
Of all the nighttime soap operas that I watched over the course of my entire life, I mean, we're going to like Melrose Place or Desperate Housewives, things like that. Knott's Landing was the formative and the best of those to me. And here's the reason it started. It was the spinoff of Dallas, which was huge, but Dallas was all about rich people. And Knott's Landing was a soap opera that went on for like 17 years, but it was all centered on a cul-de-sac. So anytime that they wanted to introduce a new family with a new set of secrets, all they would do was just move them into the house of whoever left the show the previous year.
Oh, okay.
And when I was first attracted to one of my best friends, we met on like a chat, and the first thing that we talked about was Knott's Landing, and we ended up talking about Buffy the Vampire Slayer to an extent. But Knott's Landing, this is going to sound so ridiculous, but I think I learned how to be the gay man that I am from Nicolette Sheridan. Like, if that makes any sense. I don't know if you know who that is.
I'm not, you know, it's one of those names that I'm like, that's a celebrity's name, but I couldn't tell you why I know them.
All right. So did you watch Desperate Housewives?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay, so Edie Britt, the town slut, who eventually ended up like suing Mark Cherry and leaving the show and all of that stuff.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. So Nicolette Sheridan was on Knott's Landing as Paige Matheson, and Paige Matheson was at one point like involved with William Devane's character, a senator. Like, the thing with Knott's Landing, I feel like I'm just sort of rambling here, but the thing with Knott's Landing is that it took soapy twists and melodrama and elaborate murders, mm-hmm. but then set them all in this cul-de-sac among people who, you know, just had day jobs, so that then as dramatic or as bizarre as things would get, it was all stuck with people with normal everyday lives. Like Dallas was all rich people with oil, and it was all one family. Mm-hmm. Whereas soap operas that were involved in like a neighborhood or Melrose Place, like in an apartment complex, like there's no reason why in real life you would hang out with people who have, you know, stolen your baby or, you know, accidentally drunkenly crashed your car into you or murdered your husband. But like in Knott's Landing or in Melrose Place, at some point they start to comment on it. It's like, oh my God, when you realize these people are the only friends you have, what in the hell is going on with my life?
It does sound very like, it sounds like Desperate Housewives or Peyton Place or I guess like Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I always noted like, gosh, this town would be like, what is wrong with this place?
No, Desperate Housewives, like the weird thing about all of it and the best thing about all of it was the Desperate Housewives like used cast members from Knott's Landing and used cast members from Melrose Place on purpose because they understood that viewers of the genre would recognize them. At one point on Desperate Housewives, they have Doug Savant's father show up. Now, Doug Savant played Matt on Melrose Place, who's like a whole thing that we have to talk about. But his father was played by Ryan O'Neal. Now, Ryan O'Neal plays a character named Rodney on Desperate Housewives. And Rodney was the character's name of Ryan O'Neal's character on Peyton Place.
Oh,
and they talk about how Rodney is getting divorced from Allison, and Allison was his girlfriend, Mia Farrow's character, on Peyton Place. So that, like, Peyton Place begat Dallas, begat Knott's Landing, begat Homefront, which is this show in the 1940s where Kyle Chandler at age 22 played a baseball player, and oh my God, my voice would change. He was gorgeous. Anyway, so I'm getting too excited and I'm talking too much.
Well, no, this is great. And then it sounds like Desperate Housewives came out of all that tradition.
Yes,
and then,
Desperate Housewives
leads on to who knows what, like, I don't know what came out of Desperate Housewives. I feel like Real Housewives, like reality shows, were the next evolution.
Yeah, Real Housewives came from Desperate Housewives, but Desperate Housewives so far has led to Mark Cherry creating other shows like Devious Maids, which was on Lifetime and had Susan Lucci in it. And now he's doing Why Women Kill for CBS All Access, which is now Paramount Plus.
What a name for a series.
Why Women Kill's fucking great. Can I say that? Why Women Kill's like, all right, so Why Women Kill takes place in the first season took place in three different time periods. It's got like a murder in the 50s, a murder in the 70s, and a murder currently. And they all are set in the exact same house. And
oh, that sounds great. And I can see why, like, somebody who as a kid had an interest in dramatic, melodramatic, I don't know. I'm thinking of like the organ playing in a radio soap opera drama. How that show kind of evolves from that tradition.
Well, one of the things about Knott's Landing was that my parents watched it. And it was one of the things that I was actually allowed to watch with them. And usually during Dallas, I was too young. I would ask entirely too many questions. It interrupted the show. By the time Knott's Landing came on, and Knott's Landing, with its murders and its cliffhangers, started to compel me, I started watching it in separate rooms from my parents just because I was obsessed.
What did your parents think of this weird little kid they had who loved these adult dramas? Because I was born in 1980, so my impression of Knott's Landing whole life was, this is a show for grownups that I don't fully understand.
See, I was born in 76, and I was precocious, and I had cerebral palsy, so I never really went outside to play anyway, particularly here in the South, like everyone else is outside playing baseball and whatnot. So I would stay inside at home and read the backs of the TV guide where all the like movies would be listed, and I would memorize those, which for ages just made me really good on a bar trivia team and like no other practical usage whatsoever.
Yeah.
But
I'm familiar with that, where you can like name the years that Susan Lucci was up for an Emmy or something like that.
And so the thing with like soap operas and with Knott's Landing, with all these like domestic soap operas where they're all set in a house, like my house growing up, like my parents were divorced and remarried, and I had issues with all of these people that I couldn't necessarily talk about. But you go and you watch a traditional sitcom, something like Family Ties or Cosby Show, and everyone is happy. And by the end of the half hour, everything is like normal and fine. Whereas you watch Knott's Landing and everybody's plotting against one another. And Donna Mills, who is fantastic, Donna Mills at one point walks into a room where her daughter is standing over a dead body. And so she thinks her daughter has committed this murder. And then the daughter didn't commit the murder, but thinks Donna Mills committed the murder. So the two of them, go and hide Peter Hollister's body together. No. It gets better. It gets better. Donna Mills and her daughter Olivia bury this body of Peter Hollister in the middle of the night in this new playground that's being set up as part of this like development that they're coming up with. And so they bury it, and they know that a sidewalk is going to be laid there the next day. And so she thinks she's gotten away with it. Donna Mills thinks that she's gotten away with it. She thinks she's protected her daughter from being accused of murder, and her daughter thinks that she's protected her mother from being accused of murder. But then Michelle Lee, in the final moments of the season finale, and it was fantastic, is looking over the sidewalk that's been laid. And she looks over at Donna Mills and she goes, "Oh, look at that. There's a crack in the foundation. Oh, we're just going to have to pull this all up." And So you know that the body's going to be found. You know that the murder's going to be discovered. You have to wait 3 or 4 months to find out what's going to happen. And that was more like my own childhood.
Okay, wait, hold on. We need to unpack that. I was going to say, like, you're really selling me on Knott's Landing, and that now I feel like I should watch it. But in what way was this like your own childhood?
So I'm a survivor of abuse. And when I was 12 or so, I kept all of these, from 12 on, I kept all of these secrets just inside. I was writing a journal, and I would leave all the stuff that was happening to me out of the journal. And so things were complicated, like more complicated perhaps with my feelings or with things that were going on. And I started to take on like a fear that if I told the truth about anything that was happening to me, that it was going to like destroy not just my life, but like my mother's life, or that I would get blamed for things because someone else would speak out before I did. So I was like always on edge, and was not the most pleasant of memories. But you get this sense sometimes when you're growing up, you're going to pretend like everything is fine. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, all of this stuff is going on and no one necessarily knows about it.
And yeah, well, that sounds like a feeling that would be familiar to for different reasons to a lot of queer people. I imagine that like just compounded the pressure that you must have felt.
It did, partly because there was unfortunately everything was all wrapped up together, like who I am and who I'm attracted to. And then there's what is happening to me. And so then it was like, wait a second. Is what is happening to me causing me to think that I'm attracted to someone, but really it's just because of what's happened? Or am I attracted to someone and that's something to be dealt with apart from what's going on? The first person that I ever told about what was happening at my house was my high school guidance counselor when I was 17 years old. Her name is Marjorie Wilson, and she saved my life. Delightful, delightful woman. But another thing that helped me all through high school, and this is going to sound so nerdy, I promise you, I don't mean to come across as this much of a geek, but I do feel in talking to you that I am not alone. So around sophomore year of high school, while all of this was happening, one of my ways of coping was by writing my own soap opera.
Wow. Okay. Tell me about that.
It was called Horizon. I wrote it in a notebook with my best friend, Vicky, who is still my best friend to this day. And occasionally, in order to escape the reality of what was going on in my house, I got a typewriter and I would sit at a desk and just type out what all the characters' names were and how they were all related to one another. And it was not at all grounded in any sort of like logic or reality. I would just write to cliffhanger and then write to the next cliffhanger and then write to the next cliffhanger. All I knew were the tropes of what a soap opera had to have in it. Like, they all had to work in the same industry. So I, for some reason, made them like airplane manufacturers.
Oh, okay.
It was stupid. It was really stupid and thoroughly delicious because, again, it's a soap opera. So you don't have to know the logic of what they're doing to work because no one's ever at work anyway. No one's ever at work. No one's ever going to the bathroom. Like, basically, everyone's just sort of yelling and plotting with one another and breaking up. Like, that's essentially the laws of soap opera.
Yeah, I gotta say, like, the phrase really stupid and delicious, I'm sold. Like, that's a fantastic pitch.
No. That's the thing. Like, now I would watch daytime soap operas, but nighttime soap operas are different. They have this, well, they have a bigger budget, and you're not with them every day. And you get the sense, occasionally, like, eventually everyone has to end up either rich or at the center of like every job. So I think Karen, who's played by Michelle Lee on Knott's Landing, I think Karen at one point ran a car dealership, was a talk show host, was a widowed single mother of three. Valene, who was a character who spun off from Dallas, was this bumpkin whose mother was Julie Harris, who's fantastic. Julie Harris played Lily Mae, this country music singer. And her daughter, I'm sorry, her son, her long-lost son, was Alec Baldwin. And Alec Baldwin was a televangelist named Joshua who fell off of a billboard and died. Mm. This happened like every year. Like, someone would just get hideously killed or murdered every year.
This is also reminding me now of Mary Hartman.
Oh, yes. I saw your episode about that with the first gay married couple. I tried to watch Mary Hartman, but the DVDs are like $200 or so
for the full season.
Because there's like – and the thing – so you'll watch clips of Mary Hartman, and Mary Hartman is a little bit like Desperate Housewives as well because it's funny and intentionally funny.
The
thing with Knott's Landing and Melrose Place was that they were funny, but they never had, but they were never allowed to openly acknowledge that they were amusing.
Mm-hmm.
Desperate Housewives had Doug Savant and Marcia Cross on it. Marcia Cross was from Knott's Landing, and Doug Savant was from Melrose Place. Doug Savant from Melrose Place was Matt from Melrose Place, who was a landmark gay character.
Yeah, well, tell me about like seeing that character. So I never watched Melrose Place, but I'm aware of the pretty groundbreaking character that they had on the show in the 90s. What was your experience with his appearance and his relationships?
All right, here's the thing with Matt from Melrose Place and how it has like affected how I view gay characters should be written from now on. Melrose Place put Matt as the gay neighbor into the apartment complex where everyone else was lying and cheating and plotting. But Matt started as a social worker. Matt was not allowed to be anything other than aspirational. Mm-hmm. So that while, like, you know, 15 other people are having multiple affairs with Grant Cho and stuff like that, because everyone else was allowed to be hot and flawed and complicated, And Matt, because he was an aspirational gay character, didn't get near the amount of stuff to do that everyone else did, partly because they were uncomfortable showing gay kisses on TV. They like cut away from his gay kiss. The one kiss he was allowed to have, I think it was going to be with Greg Evigan or something.
Yeah. Doesn't like the camera like pans away or something like
it
that.
It cuts to Andrew Hsu's slack jawed face.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. It's a reaction shot.
Yeah. Like, so instead you get Billy Campbell's just slack jawed face. And yeah.
Talk about like centering straight people in a gay relationship. We don't even get to see them kiss.
Part of me, if I was writing Melrose Place, I would put Matt into the middle of a love triangle with like Jack Wagner and Heather Locklear. At one point, Doug Savant, to his credit, tried to play, like, they eventually made him an orderly at the hospital because everyone has to be connected somewhere. In some way, and it didn't make sense for him to be a social worker anymore because there was no way to like embroil him in the drama. But he still wasn't allowed to like find anyone hot, particularly. At one point, he is essentially a henchman for Thomas Calabro's character, Michael Mancini, who Michael Mancini was the guy who was like sleeping with Marcia Cross when she ripped her own hair off. Like the wig reveal it's one of the best wig reveals in history was the Melrose Place episode where Kimberly takes off her wig. It's crazy. She was just in a car accident and comes back from the dead and turns out that she has like a horrible scar on the side of her face and she's demented and going to kill everybody. Marcia Cross was brilliant. Marcia Cross remains brilliant. She's fantastic. But okay, so Matt was allowed to be an orderly who was trying to keep everyone safe and comfortable. He was the steadying morality, which, you know, is a good thing for like mainstream audiences to feel comfortable among gay characters. It's just that it also does a disservice to us as people, if we're not allowed to be as complicated as everyone else on screen.
Right, right. On one hand, he's maybe he's got his act a little bit more together, but that also means that maybe he's a little more boring than the other characters.
Yes, they eventually wrote him, like eventually Doug Savant left the show and they wrote him off in a like off-screen car accident. Mm-hmm. Where it's then revealed that he kept a diary that had secrets for everyone else in the apartment complex. And it's like, damn it. If you had had that diary the whole time, then we would have known that you were like keeping track of everybody. It would have been way more interesting for all of this to happen before you died rather than after it. But they decided to retroactively make Matt flawed because they weren't allowed to make Matt flawed or give him much of a sex drive. Mm-hmm. Like, on screen. At one point, the actor, Doug Savant, said that he was trying to play it as though he was attracted to Michael, but the directors or someone told him to stop that. And another thing that happened was that Doug Savant, during the early days of Melrose Place, when it first came on, I believe got studio notes where they were telling him to come out as heterosexual in the press so that that way they would know that, you know, they weren't actually infiltrating, you know, homes with an actual gay person. But Doug Savant, to his credit, because that man is a badass, Doug Savant refused to come out as straight in the media so that that way they couldn't make Matt more dismissible, I suppose. Is what I'm saying clear?
Yeah, yeah. So you had a lot of different soap operas kind of like swirling around you. And I guess it sounds like this was sort of a escape from what was also a pretty dramatic and difficult situation that you were in real life, to the point where you were like, you're creating your own, right? You're creating your own soap opera as sort of an escape until, well, and you said that there was the guidance counselor who helped you, who you said saved your life and,
yes,
and got you out of that situation. Where did you like when it was time for you to actually escape from the difficult circumstances that you were in? Where did you go and how did you get out?
I went to college. Basically, I went to college. I proceeded to come out to my mother like 4 or 5 times.
Did it just not take?
No, what happened was because of the way in which I had to come out, it was a series of confessions. I went to University of Georgia where I was in Athens and Michael Stipe was just around town. Michael Stipe from REM, he was just around town. And he, at the time, was dating a friend of mine. So I just sort of tested the waters and asked my mother, like, I think he's attractive. What would you think? I think I might be attracted to guys. What would you think of that? My mother said, choose another option. Yeah. So then the second time that I came out, I was dating a man named Ashley, which I thought was really, really, really useful because then I could just talk about Ashley all the time. But unfortunately, I dropped pronouns. Isn't it terrible the ways in which if you look back on yourself at age 20 and you see the horrible, horrible mistakes and the way you treated people, but there's no way to go back and fix it, is there? You just learn, I guess.
Yeah, well, hopefully. If you're lucky, you learn.
Then eventually I told her about what had happened to me when I was a kid, which then was like the third time I sort of tried to come out. And then like the fourth time that I came out, I think that I just told her that I had a boyfriend. And then by then RuPaul had a talk show. And so then I remember this, she and I were dancing in our living room to Dead Can Dance's You Spin Me Right Round. And all of a sudden I'm like, okay, I guess I'm out to my mother and it's okay.
What do you think made that okay? Was it like having... It sounds like RuPaul's talk show and the music and, like, I don't know, having like sort of a third party of gayness like off to the side made it something that you didn't need to talk about or didn't need to be dramatic anymore?
No, it's just the way in which culture tends to normalize what we are to people who want to other us, basically. My mother doesn't have to think about me and abuse. My mother doesn't have to think about me and like dates with guys who she doesn't know. My mother instead just gets to like listen to disco music and deal with RuPaul, and RuPaul is funny, and suddenly it becomes suddenly it switches from being like this is happening to someone that I've known from birth, who I am responsible for, to like, this is a comfortable situation that I can live with because it's just dancing and joy and happiness. Mm-hmm. It's a framing thing. You don't have to worry about your kids being sick. You don't have to worry about your kids being othered, which my mother, since I have cerebral palsy, always had to do anyway. Like, she always had to be intensely protective of me to the point where she was reading the journals that I knew she was reading. So I kept my own abuse out of them.
Once you were out, like not just to your mother, but it sounds like at college you could be out to, like in general. What changed for you?
Well, one of the things that happened was that I found a gay soap opera. That was kind of the best. And a lot of people have mentioned it on your show before. I was reading the books by Armistead Maupin, the Tales of the City books. At that point, there were only 6 of them. But then I realized with characters like Michael from Tales of the City that, like, unlike Matt from Melrose Place, like, we could be complicated and twisted and having, you know, affairs we shouldn't be having and accidentally involved in murders and stuff like that. I mean, that's not what I want. I don't want to accidentally be involved in a murder. But sure. I would like to be seen as a layered, complicated, not necessarily good person. Mm-hmm. So by the time that I was out to everyone, I developed this reputation of being dramatic. I always tell people I'm not dramatic. I'm emotional. Like, I'm not faking anything. But I was working for a newspaper. I was working for a newspaper, and I was dating someone who was a drag queen. We all lived in the same dorm, and he staged his own hate crime and set fire to his dorm door like 3 or 4 times. And yikes. Then, and it was in the newspaper. And then I'm like hanging out his house, and the police have put a camera into his peephole to catch the person who is setting fire to his door and all the gay paraphernalia on his door. But it turned out that he was setting them himself, which they knew because he did it. Like, he set the next fire out of view of the camera. And so what I started to realize was that maybe either I make terrible dramatic choices based upon like culture that I watch. Like, for some reason I've normalized turning my life into a soap opera, or life is just complicated and culture reflects that.
Well, I mean, it sounds like maybe both are possible.
Isn't that a comfort?
I guess. Well, where did you come down? Like, what was your, like, ultimately, what did you decide was going on there?
I realized that I could be more rational. I went into therapy and am still in therapy. But then I also can take the stage as a storyteller or write stories where there are cliffhangers every week or cliffhangers every chapter. My book is called Impacted, and it's about a gay teen father who has gotten a girl pregnant, but is also involved in a relationship with his dentist, who's a good deal older. And over the course
of pregnancy. Is Impacted a pun on dental, on teeth that are impacted?
Yes, it's that. But no, it goes further than that. At the end of the first chapter, he takes just this like ceramic mouth and bashes the dentist over the head as well, so that Impacted in terms of like pounding in something is also like the double impact of the title. And a lot of it, weirdly, the title of that comes from the fact that when I was in college and working for the newspaper, and when I worked for the newspaper as well, I was a copy editor frequently, and the word impacted was something that people would use when they meant to have an impact, and I was told that was never right, that there's having an impact or making an impact versus to impact something is to literally pound something in.
Mm-hmm.
And so the double meaning of that became something that I was interested in writing about, and that's what it ended up being the title of my book.
Tell me about your transition. Like, it sounds like you were in journalism for a long time, and then you weren't. What happened there?
I was working for CNN, but also like 24, 25, like as an editor. And I was trying to be out in Atlanta and just sort of fun and gay and social at the same time as I was trying to hold down a day job. And I didn't like the day job, and the people who worked with my direct supervisors had real problems with me as a gay person, but then also like me as a 22-year-old who thought he could just half-ass anything. So eventually I got let go. So then I was just freelancing. There was no money in newspapers. I ended up working for Barnes & Noble for a time. Then I worked for McGraw-Hill for a while. Essentially, I utilized my copy editing skills to just sort of maintain employment, or my data entry skills or my data collecting skills as a journalist. But then my writing and all of the things that I'd honed in J school, part of it came from practical, direct messaging, which is necessary in newspapers. And then also there's a certain amount of color in journalism, in newspaper journalism, that they would teach me. My professor, my favorite professor, his name was Conrad Fink. And he was this old grizzled AP reporter with these gigantic eyebrows who like had covered Vietnam. when he was saying how to cover stories, he was telling people essentially that what you need to do, like he said, I want to know the color of the towel that the woman hanged herself with.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden you realize that instead of flowy, ornate, decorative language, that it's possible to write these just short, blunt, tacky, direct sentences. You can go back in the 50s and or things like that. You can find books by Jim Thompson or Dashiell Hammett that deal with a sort of grittier, more sarcastic voice. And those weren't seen as classics at the time. They were just seen as like blunt pulp. Or Patricia Highsmith and The Talented Mr. Ripley, which may be the first gay thriller ever written in terms of fiction, but it had to be coded. She couldn't say specifically what was going on with Mr. Ripley.
Right. So you had like a background in storytelling, and not just writing like journalism as a technical recitation of facts, but using economic details to do essentially the kind of storytelling that you were already familiar with from soap operas, except it was about stuff that was true.
Yes.
And then it sounds like, and then did you take that back to fiction? Like after you like stepped away from journalism, like, did you like basically realize that your craft had been honed in a way that allowed you to tell better stories?
I did. A lot of what I had to learn when I was learning how to write fiction was how to make sure that all the characters' voices didn't sound like mine, but how that the overall tone of a narrator still carried, I guess, my sensibilities, my sense of humor. If you go back, you can find this great book about writing by Lawrence Block called Telling Lies for Fun and Profit, which treated the act of writing a book, this aspirational thing that I'd always wanted to do, but treated it in a very like, write 500 words a day for a year and you have a book. Practical, broken down, mathematical tasks, so that it didn't seem it didn't seem aspirational. It didn't seem out of reach. It still was artistic and it still was creative, but it was something that you could work at and play at and do practically. And then as I was writing the book, I was writing it in like Dunkin' Donuts until 4 a.m. essentially every night for a year. As I was doing that, I started to write to Cliffhanger and just send it to two or three friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And as it was coming out, I just thought that I was writing a series of Cliffhanger stories. I didn't intend to write a full book. But as I revealed the secrets of this character, like at first he's just breaking up with the dentist in the most violent way possible. And then he is a father, but then it also turns out that he's a teenager. And he's trying to keep, and he lives in his mother's basement. He's trying to keep all of these secrets all at once. A lot of what I wrote about, I realized was like, either things I had not dealt with or things that were dealt with badly in my own childhood. And there are some scenes toward the end of the book where they were conversations between a character and his parent that were like better versions of the ways in which I dealt with things with my own parents, which is not the easiest thing to discover while you're just trying to like have fun as a sort of side project, but it makes the book better. And it also, it also means, and I hope that this means that anyone who reads the book will feel less alone, that they'll find a sort of connection to what the characters are going through and how they're processing them.
Did that make you feel better? Like, did writing those things and I guess portraying a better experience than what you had, like, was that helpful for you?
Yes, very much so. The reason, because I didn't realize in all of the day-to-day pretending that everything was okay, that that there was stuff that I still needed to, like, unearth and process. Because eventually, life isn't just how you were traumatized or victimized by the things that happened to you. They just start to ingrain in how you date and how you live and how you process someone offering affection to you. It just becomes all of this baggage that you carry around. And weirdly, writing the book means that you have to start to unpack all of these things. And, like, even just the pettiest or smallest little annoyance from when you were a kid turns out better in scenes. And when it's not happening to you, but you're able to create someone who things happen to, but they weather it differently, you start to create your own community. And then also in storytelling, like live storytelling, like The Moth, which I've done on stage, where you share experiences of your own trauma with a room full of people, you inevitably find that there are other people at different stages of similar or the same trauma who will come up to you and let you know that you aren't alone. I used to have to go to soap operas in order to be able to find people whose lives on TV I could relate to in terms of representation, like Matt from Melrose Place, or like Valley Ewing on Knott's Landing, who's going through hell constantly and can't seem to find her way out of it.
After having that experience with the book, it sounds like then you had actual people rather than fictional characters that you could turn to.
The storytelling gives you a community. The book hasn't come out yet. The book comes out July 6th. I hope that when they find the book, that survivors of abuse will be able to either tell me that I got it right or tell me that that was not their experience. Hopefully I will not be chased down with torches and pitchforks, but even that's valid, I suppose. And I have to be comfortable with that. A friend of mine told me that writing a book is essentially in some way inviting people to just randomly come up and kick you in the nuts. And that's what I'm afraid of. But at the same time, storytelling is, or speaking openly about childhood sexual abuse and the prevalence of it automatically causes people to come up to you and relate to you either their own experiences or to express gratitude to you for voicing those experiences. It's incredibly helpful to know that you're not alone. People who think, the problem, abusers are able to utilize the shame around keeping something secret or feeling, or a victim feeling responsible for his own abuse as a way to make sure that the secrets stay hidden, that these things remain behind closed doors. And it allows this sort of abuse to perpetuate, which is not helpful to people who are surviving it. It's helpful instead to create a shame cycle. It's the sort of thing that keeps gay people in the closet. It's the same sort of shame that it's the comfortable veneers of white picket fence living that treat the secrets of what's actually going on with us as though they should remain secret. These aren't it's better to talk about things. It's better to be out. It's better to find help and know that you're not alone. And for the people who want to pretend that life is just some comfortable family sitcom, that's one thing. And to me, and what I come to find is that life is more like a drama to everybody else, particularly to the ones who are trying to pretend like everything's fine. I'm sure that there is a normal family who's comfortable and functional out there somewhere. I've never met them. And I think that Tolstoy in Anna Karenina, in the first line of Anna Karenina, I don't want to misquote this because it's famous, is like, all happy families are alike. All unhappy families are unhappy in their own way.
Mm-hmm.
It's because there are no happy families, not completely. Everybody's got complications and secrets. And
where can folks find you online, and where can folks go to check out your book?
I'm at benjicarr.com, BenjiCarr.com. My book should be available nationwide. It's on Amazon, and it's called Impacted. It comes out July 6th.
Benji, thanks so much for joining me.
I appreciate it.
Thanks to Benji for joining me, and thanks to you for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/MattBaum to support the show and get backer rewards. Check my YouTube for deep dives into queer pop culture history at youtube.com/MattBaum, and my newsletter at mattbaum.com. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.